Sure. So I'm Dr. Liz Pearson. I'm a lecturer in the Law and Criminology Department at Royal Holloway, University of London. And I'm interested in research on extremism with a focus on gender and also counter-extremism. And I've looked at extremism in a UK context and also online and in the context of Nigeria and the Lake Chad Basin and the group that's known as Boko Haram.
I just wanted to double check one thing. Should I address you as Liz or Elizabeth? Or how would you like to be
Liz is
introduced?
fine.
Liz
It
is
written
fine.
down, probably use my full name, but Liz is absolutely fine, yeah.
Okay, so the host, I'll let him know that it's to introduce you as Liz, right?
Yeah,
Okay,
sure.
yeah, great. And so
Liz, I'm keen to understand, is terrorism still a threat globally?
I think it's a big question. And when we're asking ourselves questions about terrorism as a threat, we have to think about where, what, and how. So when we think about terrorism now, I think often people, the public probably thinks of the terrorist groups that they've heard most recently mentioned in the media, in the press. So perhaps, 5, 6 years ago, we would have been thinking of Islamic State because they were the group that was carrying out attacks that was most often in the headlines. And perhaps now there's more of a focus in the media on far right groups. But terrorism is always evolving. We've had terrorist groups really since, the middle of the 19th century. We start off with anarchist terrorism, and then we've had far left groups. Looking back into the 1970s, we've had post-colonial terrorist groups which were fighting for liberation and freedom. So we've always had different threats, and the threat that is considered the most important in a particular time and place, it tends to be what people think of as the sort of current terrorist threat. So whilst it's true that, Islamic State was in Western countries seen as a huge threat from around 2013, 14, until really the loss of its territories 2019, and then we had COVID, of course, which has interrupted things. We don't know at the moment how things will evolve. I think we're still in this kind of post-COVID world. Many people have become interested in the intersection between conspiracy theories and extremism, between the far right and conspiracy theorists, between the manosphere and people online who have got misogynist views, and their intersection with the far right and indeed with, Islamist groups. So it's difficult to say that there is no threat, but it's also hard at the moment to say who that's from. And, if you're looking at that from an American perspective, that's obviously going to differ from looking at that from the perspective of people living in Syria and Iraq or Afghanistan, where there are, on a daily basis, perhaps attacks. So it depends very much on the context and, who's asking that question, I think.
That's really interesting. And you also mentioned that there are so many factors intersecting these days when it comes to extremism. And based on that, I was wondering if the tactics that people use to recruit people into extremist groups are the same. Do people join groups using online platforms? Or because there are so many intersectional factors coming together, like socioeconomic factors and religion, have extremist groups started radicalizing using other techniques?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's a really interesting question whether it's still the same. You mentioned online, and I think the internet has been a real site of concern since we had the prevalence of preachers like Anwar al-Awlaki, who was obviously an American, who was an extremely popular English language preacher and had high numbers of in terms of audience across the world, hit great reach. The governments and security services have been really concerned concerned about the ease and accessibility of propaganda that, you know, in previous ages would have been disseminated on cassette tapes, for instance, or, you know, in leaflets. So the internet has certainly made it much easier for those preachers to disseminate materials, or for intellectual ideologues of whatever ideology to disseminate their materials. But there remains a big question around whether this idea of, you know, online radicalization, or at least pure online radicalization, someone who could be entirely radicalized on the internet, there's still a big question mark over the degree to which that happens and is possible. Most often we have seen kind of the internet is obviously a big part of our life. So the internet has been important as a factor in radicalization. But we've seen that real places offline, real relationships offline have also been very important. If I point to a sort of case in the UK of Shamima Begum, who's been in the news a lot recently over her attempts to return from Islamic State, what was Islamic State territory, back to the UK. You know, she's been trying to do this for some time. It was thought that she and her two schoolgirl friends who traveled over there in 2015, you know, this idea of online radicalization was really important, but she traveled with a group of real friends. They knew people who'd gone over there. So the internet was only part of the story of how that radicalization had happened. Now, I mentioned, though, that it does depend partly on where you are. So European radicals, people who'd gone off to join Islamic State from Europe, we know that the internet was really important. The internet was a really crucial part of Islamic State strategy in terms of putting out their videos, highly effective videos with very high production values, very reminiscent of the kinds of games that young people, teenagers, would play. So that's an important part of their strategy. When you're talking about the United States, though, because you've got that greater degree of distance between the site of conflict that people were being asked to travel to, Iraq and Syria, at that golden age, in inverted commas, of Islamic State, where they were calling for people to join them as fighters and propagandists, then the internet becomes more important when you're at that greater distance, because there is less chance that people will interact offline with other people who are familiar with Islamic State and how to get there. So that relevance and importance of the internet slightly depends on where you are. Again, absolutely, Islamic State and any other group that's you know, trying to recruit in recent years, the internet has been extremely important to them, but it hasn't been the only thing that's important. Now, I mentioned also that I'm interested in gender. And one of the things that I and my colleagues found when we were doing research, this is a few years ago, in 2015 and 16, research I was doing with a London-based think tank called RUSI, we found that actually the internet was really important in gender terms, thinking about young women's radicalization to, we were looking at Islamic State specifically. And that was because of the kind of restraints and constraints that young women faced versus young men in terms of, you know, where they could go without accompaniment, how easy it was for them to be approached in the street. You know, street radicalization was at that time in Europe a problem in terms of Islamist, jihadist preachers, you know, basically accosting young men when they were coming out of mosque, giving them pamphlets, encouraging them to come to meetings. And young women, they weren't unaccompanied in that way. So they were easier for radical groups like Islamic State to contact secretly online. They were accessible in a different way from young men. And that's to do with a range of factors. So again, the answer to how important the internet is, well, that it depends. And one of the things it depends on is gender, is location, is the ideology of the group that's doing the recruiting, and perhaps some of the cultural factors that matter in terms of the specific demographic that they're trying to recruit.
Taking all these factors into account of, you know, culture, gender, location, what does de-radicalization look like?
So there are so many groups that are working on de-radicalization. It's clearly a really important part of any strategy, government strategy, is to work to de-radicalize people who are one-to-one. So in my convinced to work authentically with such programs, we've seen de-radicalization work best, I think, when that is with trusted partners and when it works academic experience of researching. I've looked more at counter-radicalization, so those strategies which are designed to prevent people from radicalizing in the first place. But sometimes the same intervention providers are also working to de-radicalize and to de-escalate when people have had contact with extreme groups, have become convinced to a certain extent that they're sort of in some of the same intervention providers are working in that space to de-radicalize. So there's a difference between de-radicalization and disengagement. In European context, I think the emphasis is on de-radicalization to stop young people to make them no longer commit to those ideas. If you're looking at a context like Nigeria, where you've had a group, the jihadist group Islamic State West Africa Province, and also Jemaat al-Sunnah Dawati wal Jihad, which is known as Boko Haram. So those groups have been very important in recruiting fighters who are perhaps, you know, doing this for money, not necessarily through ideological conviction. So then it might not be that you're thinking about de-radicalization, getting rid of that ideology, because they've never really truly been bought into the ideology. It's been about convincing them that fighting for these jihadist groups isn't the best thing for them going forward. It's not the only place where they can get money or where they can get status. Then that's much more about disengagement. So the emphasis, I think, I don't know where the, in answer to your question, where is the emphasis now? You know, that's very dependent on the, again, the specific country and the specific ideology which is causing the most problems at any given time.
Liz, I'm also keen to understand whether, as a society, people questioned why certain people become extremists and whether they wonder if, you know, these people who've got radicalized end up becoming complete strangers who preach hate. Is that sort of the thought process in society? Are these questions being asked or should they be asked?
Well, if you look at societies where, I mentioned Nigeria because it's had a very successful kind of program of rehabilitation for fighters who have said that they want to be rehabilitated. But it's very, very difficult to get community buy-in, community trust. When your community has been damaged by an extremist group, it is, of course, human nature, I think, to be very wary of the idea that those individuals that you know have perhaps killed people that in from your community, to be able to trust them again, no matter how many de-radicalization or disengagement programs that they have been through. So you have to have sort of community buy-in to these programs. And in the Nigerian context, that's been extremely hard to get. People are extremely stigmatized. And the term terrorist and the term extremist, they are, by their nature, very pejorative terms. They suggest that what the person is engaged in is a completely illegitimate, morally illegitimate pursuit. You know, that's why some people prefer the term political violence, because that term terrorism already delegitimizes. It's pejorative. It's a bad person in pursuit of a bad cause doing things which are not justified. I mentioned Nigeria, but, you know, you talked about Shamima Begum. And if you look at kind of surveys of British attitudes towards Shamima Begum, I think, I don't know which when the last survey was done, but surveys that I have seen by organised by newspapers showed very high levels of popular mistrust of her, of her motives, and very little public desire to see either Shamima or people like Shamima returned. And of course, that's partly to do with just the facts of what she did traveling over to Islamic State. There's very little sympathy for the fact that she was young, or that she may have been, you know, groomed by Islamic State strategists to travel over there. People are not keen to see, at least in this country context, young women like her return. But in fact, women have already returned, and so far they've done so successfully. And it's before there was perhaps the media kind of storm over Shamima Begum herself. And it's a really important issue, because at the moment, what people tend to think less about is what the situation is in Syria and Iraq and how that will evolve. The numbers of Europeans or Western young women that are still there and are radicalizing young men. We've had children now are coming of age in the camps such as Al-Hol, which we know are extremist hotbeds. They are places where women are organizing essentially their own kind of systems of retribution and justice within those camps. There are no-go zones in those camps. So it's extremely important for the future stability in Iraq and Syria, which may or may not have impacts on the future stability of Europe. So it's a short-termist kind of view not to consider people like Shamima Begum, the responsibility of the British government to be brought back, to be rehabilitated, to be de-radicalized, and to be removed from a situation in which they may pose more risk, essentially. And that's a question, that question of rehabilitation is one that countries across Europe have been facing, and some have been facing this better than others. You know, Belgium has already, and Germany have returned young women like Shamima Begum. I haven't been following what the kind of media or public response has been to that in those countries, but that's the kind of route that I think most people with knowledge about the situation there and with knowledge of the future risk that they pose would advocate.
Do you think it's easy to flip a former extremist and bolster peace? Because, for example, if you get into a habit like, let's say, smoking, it's not very easy to quit. It takes time, and the triggers to start smoking again are present. So even with extremists, former extremists, they might undergo triggers that might want them to go back on that radicalized path again. So are there any support systems to help them out, especially if they're prone to trigger factors?
Yes, and I think the cases where people have been brought back to the UK already, they're involved in it's a multi-agency approach. So clearly the intelligence services are working to ensure that those people do not pose a risk. The Criminal Prosecution Service is working to see if there is a chance of a reasonable prosecution, if there is evidence that they have broken the law. And of course, evidence from Iraq or Syria from the period of Islamic State is not easy to come by. Social services are working to, if they're coming back with children, for instance. Mental health services and health services are working with people, and de-radicalization experts and local community leaders may well be working with families and friends to try and ensure that their rehabilitation works as successfully as possible and that the community and family are ready to support those people. So that's an example of extremely complex needs of people and the different agencies that would be involved in the UK context in their return. And this has happened, and it has been the case, although not with Shamima Begum. Is it a simple process? No, radicalization is not a simple process. There's no one pathway to becoming radicalized, if indeed we can understand that term as having any sort of useful meaning. And that means there's no one pathway out. For each person, there will be a complex interplay between different personal factors, different community factors, different family factors, different political factors that led them into joining the group. And unpicking those factors, working with them in order to unravel someone from their involvement in that group can be a complex process. But the evidence is that this works when people are supported, that they have trust. And we have seen it work, because we've seen some of the most influential names in terms of counter-extremism in this field, in the UK or elsewhere, have been people who were formerly extremists. I think of people like Majid Nawaz, who I think had done a lot of work in the United States, amongst other places, although he is British, or Shiraz Maha, who these were people who were active with Hizb ut-Tahrir, and they have been very influential within the counter-extremism and understanding extremism space. if you look at the far right, there are countless numbers of people who were involved with far right groups, with often violent sort of neo-Nazi groups, who for one reason or another, whether it's that they become disenamored, they don't no longer believe in or buy into the violence or the ideas of the group, they leave with some difficulty. It's hard to leave all your friends behind because these are groups in which you have many friends. And they form relationships back perhaps with distant and estranged family members, and they gradually rebuild their lives again. And some of those people are the most influential, because when you're talking to young or not young radicalized people, if you haven't had that experience for yourself, if you haven't gone through what they've gone through, it's harder for them to trust you. But if they can see that someone has walked that same path, that same journey, then providing a kind of role model for them as a former can be extremely powerful. And we've seen formers play an extremely important role in both de-radicalization, disengagement, and in counter-radicalization, putting that message out there in the first place, that this isn't a path that will lead to fulfillment or happiness. We've seen different countries using different criteria. You know, there are checklists developed based on the academic literature to kind of work through to see whether someone poses a risk. We've got ERG 22, for instance. Different countries have developed their own different checklists. So there is a systematic way of ensuring that people are not a risk to themselves or to wider society. There's been a lot of research on radicalization and on de-radicalization in the past years, and it is a growing research area. Year on year, we learn more about what works and what doesn't work. So it's constantly evolving, but there are systematic procedures in place in different countries to ensure that, you know, individuals can be safely rehabilitated into society if that's the appropriate step, and that they are not going to pose a threat to themselves or others. So there is a system there in place in the UK and in other countries, but those systems do vary.
I had another question. How should media be referring to people who have been radicalized in the past? Should we be calling them former extremists? In the case of Shamima Begum in the UK, she's still referred to as a jihadi bride or an ISIS bride. And if these people are trying to integrate again in society and, start their life on a fresh page, what role can media play in helping them in the de-radicalization process?
I think, and the terms that the media use can be extremely powerful for good or for ill. And you know, in the aftermath of 9/11 and then the London transport attacks of 7/7 in 2005 in the UK, we saw Muslim communities stigmatized, complaining that they were being associated with these jihadist groups with whom the vast majority of Muslims clearly had no sympathies and nothing at all in common. We saw Muslim communities push back against the description of such groups as Muslim, as Islamic, even the term Islamist, which is about the kind of a political pursuit of Islam, people did not like because of the word Islam is in there. And they would, you know, passionately refute the idea that these groups have anything to do with what Islam really stands for. And Muslim communities that I have done research with in the immediate aftermath, for instance, of the Paris attacks, we were in Canada talking to people about the effects, you know, that Paris attacks thousands of miles away, and yet the reporting had caused Islamophobia, abuse, people's hijabs being pulled, being spat at, being subjected to racial slurs. And we know also that people of colour who were not Muslim were also subject to some of this Islamophobia simply, you know, through the fact that they were people of colour. So it is important that the media doesn't contribute to stigmatisation, and that it is able to accurately and fairly reflect what's happening. Of course, the media needs to report on cases such as Shamima Begum. Of course, they need to report on terrorist attacks. But I think to have a clear strategy around the terminology that is used is very important. The BBC, I used to work for the BBC. The BBC does not use the term terrorist unless attributing it to someone else, because they're highly aware that it's an extremely divisive, pejorative term that can create harm in particular communities. And words like, I think you mentioned, did you mention the term sort of jihadist bride? Again, you know, we've seen these kind of terms develop and have a high level of currency, but they again can be very damaging because they don't tell the whole story. They don't necessarily reflect the role that women played, which was not just about being brides. It's about being propagandists. It's about being ideologues to some degree. It's about buying into the ideology of, in this instance, Islamic State. So the media has a responsibility to its audiences to report the things that they need to know about, has a responsibility to its audiences to use that terminology. And, you know, whether that benefits someone like Shamima Begum or not is, you know, not journalists' concern, but their responsibility around reporting certainly should be a concern. And I don't think it hurts for journalists to be educated on the ways in which that kind of, you know, terrorists want to get a message out. Journalists have in the past, you know, been exploited by terrorist groups, and journalists have to be aware of their role in that kind of, in that relationship between the public, the terrorist group, and the story, and also government as well. So there's a responsibility there that's incumbent upon them, and that language is really, really matters, I would say.